This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Two things that I would like to talk about tonight. One, certainly, because we have the presence here, indeed, of evidence of the Tulsa Looper suitcases, would certainly be that project, which to me will never ever finish, so will always be ever present. It is so absurdly huge and so multivarious. And indeed, in association with what's been advertised, the new film called Goltzius and the Pelican Company, which is still not completely finished, but is in a form where I am moderately happy to be able to show you my intentions by showing you some excerpts. Okay. I don't know whether there could be a continuity between what we were talking about the other night and what I am about to continue to talk about, but indeed it is this magnum opus, this huge product of megalomania, which is, I suppose, my attempt to try and bring everything together in one place. Last time I spoke to an audience here in this city, indeed, a couple of nights ago, we were talking about the possibility of a holistic program, which would be a celebration, of course, of the information age, but would find a way to try and bring all these disparate parts together. I showed you some evidence, indeed, the other night of maybe materials which we've been associated with in the last 2 or 3 years, but in a curious way, my career is littered with odd short films that don't necessarily fit too many classifications, but are, I suppose, a continuing wish to experiment, to explore, to open doors and windows to see what's possible. But there does come a time when all these bits and pieces need some coherence, some organization. I think at heart I am no more than a clerk shuffling information, but there again I don't feel too disappointed with that definition. And we did, around about, I think, the year 2000, began to anticipate making something of a greater complexity, multi-layered. The credibility that both me and my producers can garner together has been the result, of course, of a career of about 25 years. So it was possible, certainly in the beginning stages, to find all sorts of sources of money to put together, indeed, for a grand project. That project has indeed the title, The Tulsa Looper Suitcases. I always suggest to audiences, don't worry too much about Tulsa Looper, but please hang on to the suitcases. Tulsa Looper, I suppose, is a not very transparent portrait of me in a fantasy life. It is, I suppose, an invented alter ego, and he, of course, is allowed to go to places where I would like to go, both, shall we say, in terms of drama, sexual and otherwise. But there is a way, I suppose, that the actual complete Tulsa Looper suitcases project, I say complete, which is a bit of a joke because it's far from complete and will go on and on and on, is in itself a history of my film career. Constantly, there are quotations from the 14 feature films we've made, and constantly there are quotations and references to the 50 other films we've made. So in a curious way, it is very autobiographical, sometimes very obviously, and sometimes in deep disguise, and also picks up all these bits and pieces which were started and aborted for all sorts of reasons. You know, and I know, that no work of art is almost ever, ever finished. What normally happens is the creator, the auteur, either gets bored, or the bank manager starts complaining, or the producer gets fed up, or you have to take, finally, the dog for a walk. So most products never get finished. So there is a way I could describe the Tulsa Looper suitcases as the ultimate dustbin that I could put everything in, which never saw the light of day in any other complex. The idea then was certainly to make a work that was relative to all the burgeoning, exciting new languages of the digital revolution. Primarily, let me repeat, because of my credibility in the cinema, we could raise the money to make a film. I have a long-suffering producer, a Dutchman. I met him first in 1982 at the Rotterdam Film Festival. He's about 10 years younger than me, and he actually came up to me and suggested, provided I didn't want to go to Hollywood, he would look after my film career. Well, for a filmmaker just beginning, that was in an impossible, a ridiculously impossible situation. We talked and joked. I never saw him for another 2 years, but eventually met him at the Cannes Film Festival when we had a product there. And he said, my offer stands. And I have to say, since 1984, we've been together ever since. So his sort of responsibilities, which entirely he took on himself, was basically to find the logistics and the money and the funding and the wherewithal and the networking and the distribution system to be able to support my career. And so, of course, I am deeply, deeply grateful to him. At that particular time, I lived in London, but commuting backwards and forwards between London and Amsterdam became, I suppose, itself quite a burden. So eventually, I spent more and more time in Holland, and Holland was extraordinarily generous to my activity, and I think my movies, in a sense, contain the potentiality of all the other art forms. And before very long, I was making theater there, making opera there, and certainly having exhibitions. This ability to be able to shift backwards and forwards between an exhibition, a film, a website, an opera house, and all the other associated relatives of all these activities, of course, was a very, very highly privileged situation. And in a curious way, the workload has grown and grown and grown. And I can say to you, without any, I hope, vain glory or arrogance, we must have about 30 projects going at this present moment. There is a way, of course, that I am deeply associated with a whole mass of extraordinary collaborators. I am now working for about 4 different producers. And our calendar, of course, is extremely full. At this particular moment, we are, in a sense, I suppose, between 2 films. One, indeed, is the Goltzius film, and we're about to go to Mexico to make a film about Eisenstein. And there are about 4 other films all set and ready to go, not completely financed, but almost so. So in a sense, all this activity, all this superabundance of opportunities to play, if you like, and I use the English word of play, you know, the English apparently don't take themselves very seriously, but certainly take what they do very seriously. And it's also interesting, is it not, that the English have probably invented all the world's games, but that doesn't mean to say they play them very well anymore. And I suppose that ludic concern and that awareness and that, I suppose, Monty Python-esque sort of concern for black humor and anarchy and notions of deep irony must run very, very strongly through everything that I've been associated with. The Tulsloper Suitcases, then, is really a work of an encyclopedist. I've always enjoyed all those people. I suppose the very earliest encyclopedists, maybe of a fictional nature, from, you know, Dante to Einstein, all those people who want to summon all the world's information and find a complexity that's related either to a public or a private mythology, a private or a public taxonomy. I think maybe in part that's what we all do, trying to assess and compare and organize the information in order to make it coherent for us and to be able to live alongside it and with it. Basically, the situation, again, is autobiographical. I'm 21 in 1963, an age of great anxiety about the notions of atomic power. Young people today, I'm sure, are much more concerned about questions of population overload, notions of a polluted earth, etc., etc. But we all know that behind all this still is this phenomenon of ideas that are metaphorically and literally surrounded by the idea of uranium. Uranium, the ultimate energy source. We're all told that the energy is going to run out from conventional means probably in about 10 years, and we're necessarily going to have DACT. You know and I know that all these fancy tales about wind power and wave power, they're either far too inefficient and undeveloped, or even in terms of what is currently existing in the world, woefully inadequate. You know those great wind farms that certainly dot the English Channel and all over Northwest Europe, They say, I think you need something like 42,000 of these windmills even to keep San Francisco alive for one evening. What price the rest of the world if that sort of concern and equation for energy is going to be part and part of the future? So I sincerely believe, and I suppose lots of other people do, but either say it or don't say it with notions of anxiety, that nuclear power is inevitably and definitively going to be what's going to be relevant, I think, to the way the world is energized in the next 25 years, 50 years, maybe longer. So my concern as a post-student in 63, when the anxiety was right up against our nose, in a sense, has not gone away. So there's a way we're certainly going to have to come to terms, for good or ill. And the hardest thing, of course, of atomic power is either going to be the savior or it's going to be the Armageddon. And we have to find ways and means to make sure it is the former and not the latter. The atomic number of uranium is 92. And I am used all the time to find, shall we say, non-narrative ways in which to organize my film practice. If you take a film like The Cook Thief, His Wife and Her Lover, many people think it's about cannibalism in a 20th century restaurant. For me, it's about color theory. If I make a movie called Drowning by Numbers, it's really very much about notions of numerical structure. If I make a film called Zed and Two Noughts, it's very much about the idea of the alphabet, the Western alphabet dominating all our basic systems of taxonomy and notions of scholasticism. So 92 then has become both, I suppose, a talisman, a threat, and I suppose so in certain sorts of ways, a blessing. 92 is represented very, very strongly indeed in this film project, and there are 92 suitcases. Inside each suitcase, and I'm looking at these on the floors, but I don't think they can really exemplify the intention, but I am deeply heartened that people play the game with me. Every suitcase has 92 objects, ideas, or phenomena inside it. 92 times 92 comes to a figure over 8,500. So you can see, in a sense, if every single object has its own, shall we say, feature-length associated phenomenon, what a huge, huge project this is. If I were to take suitcase 46, 246 is make 92, it is full of what I describe as Holocaust gold. And it does really retread a series of 92 different stories, all represented by a singular gold bar, which is related against anti-totalitarianism, I suppose, from 1920, certainly to 1945. In fact, the key years for this whole project would be Hiroshima to the coming down of the Berlin Wall, but I have to give it a prologue, and certainly the story is far from ended, and so literally the situation goes on. I talked the other night about what I regard as the tyrannies of notions of our cinematic practice. I talked about the tyranny of the frame, the tyranny of the actor, the tyranny of a narrative-based cinema, which is really all about the bookshop, and the tyranny of the camera. I'm not going to retread all that, but what is particularly relevant, I think, is this question of narrativity in the cinema. So the whole phenomenology, I think, of the whole project is very much about my anxiety about narrative in the cinema. At base, there are not one narrative here, there are certainly 92, and I tried to run those 92 narratives continuously through the phenomenon. That, of course, needs a lot of organization, maybe a certain amount of excessive patience from audiences to be able to track their way through this huge amount of information. And we all know, I suppose, that the linear narrative is certainly up for very, very serious reconsideration. And I don't think anybody in this room would actually read an encyclopedia from A to Z, or even this morning's newspaper from the top left-hand corner of page 1 to the bottom right-hand corner of page 30. That's just not the way we do it. But there is a way that the notion, shall we say, the daily newspaper and the encyclopedia is the palimpsest and the way perhaps to treat this subject matter, this content, this exposition. Many years ago, I made a film called The Falls, and in some ways, I suppose, the whole of the Tuzlupa suitcase is a rewrite in a much more complex way of the structures and ideas of that particular film. Behind me, certainly, is one of my mentors here, Mr. Cage, and I know that The Falls was very much based upon his ideas. You might recall, I think it was about 1948, he made a work called Indeterminacy, which was based upon a series of snippets of information, some narrative, some non-narrative. And again, Cage is continually quoted in both The Falls and certainly in the Tulsa Looper Project. But I remember that there were, in fact, 90 singular pieces of information that inimitably John Cage put forward in Indeterminacy. And there was some confusion exactly how the structure was made. And maybe I could maybe even then, even now, forgive myself for making the count wrong, but perhaps I wanted to make it wrong, because in a way The Falls was about different ways the world could end. And since I was so concerned about 92 being the association with uranium, I made John Cage's 90 stories into 92. Subsequently, when he came to London at the Alameda Theatre, I was fortunate enough to be able to work with him, and we made a documentary. It's a bit arrogant to say together, because you can imagine who was very much responsible for so many of the ideas. But again, I was a burgeoning filmmaker at that time, and I was deeply fascinated by the ways and means that he constructed his project, and we very much made our documentary exactly on the same notions of an aleatory question of various forms of, should we say, non-orthodox ways of organizing material. And of course, when I told him that I'd made a very bad arithmetical mistake, counting 92 and 90, in a curious way breaking all his laws, he was, of course, vastly amused. It's now 100 years, and we're celebrating him. And there are projects, of course, all over the world, and I'm very, very pleased to be associated with quite a number of them, certainly in South America and certainly in Europe. So in a sense, there is a way that a lot of the Tulsa Looper suitcases is a continuing homage to everything that that man stood for. I again, two nights ago, made a demonstration of the complexity. Even if there were people at that last event, I'm just going to show a section of this again to begin to make a demonstration of how incredibly complex and multi-layered this work is. The plan was, in fact, to make 92 episodes with 92 major characters, 92 major pieces of event, 92 suitcases. I have to say, cinematically, we probably only got to episode 14. My God, doesn't that sound like a shortfall? 14 out of 92. The story goes on, and there are plans to continue again, maybe intermittently, maybe once every year, to make yet another episode, because in a sense, the situation will never be completely fulfilled. But isn't that always the case with an encyclopedia? You can never complete an encyclopedia, and basically when you think you've arrived there, then all the information's out of date, and you've got to revise the whole thing and bring out another edition. Encyclopedia Britannica, I think, brings out an edition every 10 years, and so it will go on and go on and go on. What we did in the first place, then, was to make The Falls as a film. I have a Parisian publisher, and the second manifestation was as a book, and the third one, which we did with some German compatriots, was, in fact, a website, and there are plans again now to make an opera. And that, again, I think, is one of those excitements about contemporary phenomenon, how we can mutate, how we can create metamorphosis. An opera can become stage play can become a website can become a film. And that ability to shift backwards and forward seems to be an absolute gift for us all, but most specifically, I sincerely believe, it's a gift for me. Let me show you then a bit of this, just to give us a taste, and also to give an opportunity for you to cease to listen to my voice.
I think you're just pooping and snooping.
Just pooping and snooping, Mr. Looper.
Mr. Looper.
Mr. Looper. With a pair of first class.
Quality class binoculars.
Made in Germany.
Made in Germany.
Good morning, Mr.
Mr. Looper.
Bonjour, Monsieur Looper.
Good morning, Mr. Looper.
Looper.
Looper. Looper. Looper.
Mr. Looper.
Looper. Open your mouth.
I am the station dentist.
Open your mouth.
Not in there, girl.
Open your mouth.
I broke my leg.
I'm wounded.
I'm wounded.
I broke my leg.
I'm back.
I'm wounded.
I broke my leg.
When I blow the whistle,
你们必须马上跳上围墙。
You must run and climb the barrier.
想象成花园中的围墙。
Imagine it's a garden wall.
围墙的另一边有花，有保障。
There is treasure on the other side.
你们预备好了吗
？Are you ready?
小心前面的狗。
Watch for the dog.
一二三，跳。
Can you truly, Mr. Looper?
Can you truly, Mr. Looper?
Put a book that says,
put book, man
that says
man
you truly, Mr. Looper. Put a book that says man evolved from the apes in a little hot cheap suitcase along with the Holy Bible.
Good morning, Mr. Looper. I am the station master.
Morning, Mr. Looper.
I am the station master.
Morning, Mr. Looper.
I am the station master.
Morning, Mr. Looper.
To see the Tulsa Looper story as fiction, it could be told as an episodic narrative of a man and his prisoners.
The audience!
The story starts in 1921 when Looper was 10, and perhaps it is still not finished. Looper was last seen and heard of, we believe, in 1989. If he were to be alive now, he would be 92.
Okay, you expect to need to watch that sort of activity of sound, an image, an idea, for 7 hours, because the first manifestation, filmically, cinematically, indeed was 7 hours long. There was a way when we first introduced bits and pieces of this to the wider world of a certain amount of enthusiasm and certainly excitement. I remember in the year 2003, we managed to get parts of Tulsa Looper into the Cannes Film Festival, into the Berlin Film Festival, and into the Venice Film Festival, which for me, of course, was an absolute delight. But I have to say, when we finally got ourselves into position to put it into the general cinemas of the world, it was an abject failure. You could see why. Immense amounts of personalized information being threaded through with all the different ways that I imagine cinema can perpetuate itself. But it was always our intention to, certainly the back of my mind, almost to deliberately fail. Because I was very concerned, still am, by the notion that the cinema of our fathers and forefathers was no longer really relevant to contemporary imaginations for all the reasons that I'm sure you can anticipate and probably agree with, but maybe there are some you still continue, certainly maybe in this country, to disagree with. So there was an intention really not just to make a film, but also to make a series of websites which should have equal value. You know, once upon a time, you know, there was the feeling you make the film and then you sell the T-shirts. But in a curious way, the T-shirts become more important than the film. So there's a way that the website for the Tulsa Looper suitcase phenomenon is more important than the film. But because, let me repeat again, our credibility for raising money to make cinema, one in a curious way subsidizes the other. But not only was it meant to be a website and a film, it was also a series of television series using the serial form, which gave me a lot longer spaces to play with. It was also indeed a opera, and it was also a play which we performed in Frankfurt called Gold in 2004, and it's also a series of books. And also, perhaps, probably not necessarily the most successful, but most secondly successful in terms of its various manifestations, was the notion of an interactive video game, which ran for 3 years. Let me show you the trailer for that game.
In the last century, an extraordinary man called Tulse Looper archived his entire life in 92 suitcases. Although his life is still a mystery, we know that he was present at key historical events. Spending his life as a professional prisoner, he managed to collect a large amount of objects and store them in suitcases. In a way, the suitcases represent the world according to Tulse Looper. By gathering and researching the suitcases, we hope to reconstruct Tulse's life and through that discover the true nature of the 20th century.
Lasted for 3 years. The first prize, and of course you can understand probably it was associated with solving 92 complex puzzles, and all those puzzles came together to make yet another singular puzzle. The first prize was awarded to, I think, a Belgian composer who struggled with all the information, and his reward was to travel the world for 6 months visiting all the places that Tulse Looper had visited. The second prize, supposedly, was a night with Isabella Rossellini, but it was never claimed. But there was a way that the situation and the umbrella of the project allowed it to be coded and uncoded, constructed and continually deconstructed, and various of its aspects, again, were in themselves created to be almost autonomous singular products, which were sufficiently related to the parent to be obviously related to it in an important way, but also had their own individual life. Like I mentioned, suitcase 46, which contained 92 gold bars, each gold bar representing the genesis of a story about persecution, not just of the Jews, but certainly of all those other victims of the Third Reich for about, 15 to 18 years. I was interested in the whole business of narrativity, of course, and some of the best ways still of expressing and telling a story is that way that children are told stories at bedtime. But that, again, is not necessarily enough because I'm not making radio. I hope to be able to find a way in which notions of visual literacy are part of that. So we embarked, indeed, on making the 92 stories, which are relative to the 92 gold bars in suitcase 46, into forms of, shall we say, narration, telling stories in association with very sympathetic ways of handling the pictures. Take a look at this. This is just one of the stories of the 92 that are contained in suitcase 46.
The Scheherazade Commandant. The Commandant in Czechoslovakia ran his camp on the Scheherazade principle. Entertain me every day and your life will be spared. Fail to lighten my boredom and you will be thrown down the latrines, into the dog pound, under a train, onto the electric wire. The Commandant could be inventive with his punishments. But the Scheherazade principle was only a principle. The storytellers were not, in fact, in demand in the camp, because the commandant was a xenophobe German-speaking Czech, and his command of foreign languages was limited. All his guests were foreigners, mostly Poles and Russians and assorted Balkan peoples, with a few gypsies and an irregular supply of Dutch. He did have three German-speaking Austrian homosexuals under his jurisdiction, one of whom was mute and therefore not the best of storytellers. The Scheherazade principle was adapted to work in other ways. Entertain me with a song, or a dance, or a recitation, or a striptease, or an obscenity, or an act of cruelty against your fellow inmates, and you can live another day. Most people have one small trick, even if it is only employed to amuse children. Pull a foolish face, fart rhythmically, de-stone cherries with your toes, speak the Lord's Prayer backwards, juggle milk bottles, whistle through your nose, sing falsetto, bray like a donkey, do a card trick, spin a plate, count in threes. Those tricks that could be performed visually and without exotic props worked best in Czechoslovakia. But even so, few people can satisfactorily continue to amuse day after day after day with only one small modest entertainment. So these people with a limited anti-tedium vocabulary went to the wall, or rather the fence, quite quickly. Unless they could offer something else. That something else, in some cases, was a little gold. Difficult to know where the gold came from. But when you are desperate to sleep another night in a below-freezing hut, a splintered wooden bed covered in vomit without a blanket, scratching yourself down to the bone because of the jumping lice, it is amazing what resources you can stoke up from the recesses of your abilities. Realizing that his guests could produce such golden miracles, the Commandant permitted the socially under-talented to pay off their entertainment dues with gold. Needless to say, in stories like this, the Commandant grew greedy, stepped up the pressure, and became more inventive with his sadism. His, as it were, now paying guests became more inventive, meaner, more competitive, rasher, doing great injury to one another, to see another foggy day in this paradise of North Poland in the winter time. Bring me a ring a day. Bring me two rings a day. Bring me five rings a day. Work parties sent out at dawn to dig sewage trenches near a village with one deserted church and two small farms and a cobbler shop amazingly returned with gifts for the commandant. The smallest dental work of the camp's inmates was relocated. The women's quarters became suddenly a rich, mineable source, and the segregation laws became curiously lax. Even more curiously, the guards' huts were not so completely out of bounds. The commandant, by inference,
was allowing his guests to steal from their jailers. He found himself becoming a richer man. He placed half his wealth in the Deutsche Bank and the other in his own particular no-questions-asked bank, situated in a black trunk under his bed. The mute Austrian homosexual performed his Scheherazade tribute as obscene tricks. He was quite dependable as an innovator. He performed expressionlessly, which encouraged those who doubted he was truly mute to reassess their prejudices. He kept a wedding ring on his person, but not on his finger. One day it fell out of its hiding place and rang tinkling on the concrete floor of the bathhouse where the commandant and his closest cronies had assembled on one of their regular Scheherazade candlelit evenings, accompanied by the very best gold-paying guests, whose breath and bodies warmed the bathhouse just a little. Nothing was allowed to go to waste in the work camp. When the metallic sound of the spinning ring ceased to reverberate, three sets of people pounced. First, the commandant, who now knew no shame as far as gold was concerned. Second, those inmates who had failed to find the day's gold quota. And third, the Austrian performer himself. If the commandant and his eager gold-digging guests had learnt ferocious cruelty that is rarely seen outside the gates of hell, then the Austrian surpassed them. His life was in the wedding ring. He killed the commandant with a shower pipe ripped from the wall, forcing it into his mouth and his throat in a no doubt ironic attempt to make the commandant like himself, first mute and then dead. The Austrian and 49 camp guests were butchered to death in 6 minutes. The fallen wedding ring disappeared. The commandant's gold in the Deutsche Bank was safe enough, but the gold in his trunk under his bed was soon pilfered. First, wrapped in a cement sack, this gold journeyed to Warsaw and then to Vienna, transported in an armored car. It stayed in an apartment belonging to a blind man opposite the Semper depot for 6 months until it was smelted down in September 1943. And, as an oversized shining gold bar, predate stamped May 1939, to confuse any snooper, it was taken to Cologne and then Baden-Baden, where Karl-Heinz Brockler managed the Gestapo treasury of Baden-Württemberg. It stayed there almost for the duration of the war. In fact, it was removed from the bank cellars only on May 4th, 1945, by Corporal Gwilfell, who was acting on orders from Sergeant Hans Doppelmann, who was fulfilling the directive of Karl-Heinz Brockler's brother-in-law, Lieutenant Gustav Ivan Haps, who had urgent need of this gold bar, along with the 99 other gold bars that had been idling there, awaiting events, like all gold awaits events. All gold has a future and patiently waits transformation. The 99 gold bars were packed tightly and neatly in two sturdy black leather suitcases. Most of them were taken on a 4-day journey to Bolzano in North Italy, where the citizens cannot cook a good spaghetti to save their lives, their purses, or their moral reputations.
We eventually would certainly hope to be able to complete all 92 stories. I think we're down to about 15. And each maybe project, each gold bar, often has different collaborators. So on this particular one, we collaborated with the Hungarian animator, a gentleman called István Hokai. And there is a way that both he and I now have exhibitions of a lot of the material that's used in films like this all over the world. We have an exhibition coming up in Canberra in Australia very soon. I tell you all these things because you can see the proliferation. Singular red line would essentially all spring from the notion of the cinematic version of 7 hours, which provide a huge amount of information. And I suppose in terms of film ratio, maybe even the 7 hour version only uses something like 10% of what was shot. So there's a huge amount of material to continue to proliferate. And you can see it proliferating in interactive video games. You could see it again having another life here in terms of a slightly different sort of cinematic narrative storytelling form. And it exists in separate exhibitions. And indeed, looking down here, this is a manifestation, I suppose, almost about the 10th manifestation, however modest. Our first manifestation was a huge exhibition we had thanks to an English philanthropist who opened an English country house not far away from Stratford-on-Avon. And we must have had a space, I suppose, that must have been 30 times as big as what we're now sitting in. And we were able to make, shall we say, daylight exhibitions and cinematic nighttime exhibitions. So if you were to take, if you can all see these suitcases, they've all got upturned lids, and in every single lid there would be a projection which would relate in some way to the contents. And of course every single content, indeed, every single suitcase would have had, let me repeat, 92 objects, ideas, or representations of some format. Then we went to São Paulo with the exhibition and took over 2 floors of a skyscraper. And one of the incentives that I was always excited about to travel with the exhibition was to embrace, as it were, local ideas, certainly always concern ourselves with a singular list, but make sure it could be interpreted in different sorts of ways. The other fascination, I am enormously excited about making catalogues and referring to the metaphor of a film with a catalogue. And we made, of course, several catalogues and still are making more. I can just show you now in format, again, slightly removed from the central red line, because what I wanted to do was to make a draftsman's appreciation, if you like. And I did a whole series of drawings, some of which are represented in this catalogue, which indeed was an exhibition which we had 2 years ago in Locarno. I'll run through this very quickly, won't worry you with the text. But here are all the drawings that make a correspondence again with apocryphal lists of suitcase and indeed real lists of suitcase, divided and subdivided in all sorts of different ways. We actually manufactured suitcases like the one on the right there, for example, on the idea of how blood and ink is constantly sharing places in world civilization. The blood representing all the blood spilt in creating war and mayhem, and then all the ink spent in trying to repair all that war and mayhem. And indeed, we did construct suitcases like this whereby you could manipulate the various liquids. There was a concern for all sorts, shall we say, poetic manifestations which were related to all sorts of text and characters within the film. And I suppose what must be said that I was always looking for the ideal audience. And that ideal audience would see the seven-hour film, would watch the Russian and the Japanese television series, would indeed have a good look at all the websites, would read all the narratives, would be aware of all the critical apparatus, would probably go and see the opera and hopefully maybe become involved in various other forms and manifestations, one of which I talked about the other night, which was a VJ show. We have a very successful VJ show. We must have been to about, I think, 45 or 50 venues all around the world where all the same material, again, is confabulated in yet another form of media. So the project goes on. I have, I suppose, or did have, on the last count, about 300 collaborators. I think probably what I try very hard to do, though inevitably I suppose a dictator, a film director should be a benevolent dictator, but to try and give most people an opportunity to make a contribution which they really feel fulfills their own concerns. Here, for example, there's a fascination about eggs and flying, again, relative to other products we've done. And we gave a lot of information to a series of Swedish ornithologists who observed the migration of birds from North Africa to the North Pole. And they created their own offshoot exhibition, if you like, which was, of course, related to everything that you could think about that would be associated with birds. We had a project, which in fact now has been taken up by Milan. You might know in 2015, Milan hosts the next World Expo. And I had this idea about the notion of what can be seen of Earth from the moon. The Milanese authorities, looking for an idea, suggested what a great idea for their exhibition. So we are now planning the World Expo. Some parts, of course, the whole notion of who plans an expo is really up for grabs. And it is literally based upon the idea Milan as seen from the moon. Here are some of the drawings and ideas for it. We intend to sail into the air 100 helium balloons, which mark out the architectural parameters, indeed, of the Milanese exhibition, which will be held in a large piece of ground between the center of Milan and Milan Airport. There was a whole series. One of the suitcases contained love letters. Of course, there had to be 92. These were love letters sent from the trenches by Telsloop's father to his mother, and again contain a huge amount of information, background information about Telsloop's childhood. What else? Concerns about his theories of the beginnings of the world. Odds and items. Telsloop tended to be a professional prisoner, was often being locked up, and to amuse himself, he kept, as it were, I think we have to talk about the year like 1939 to 1945, where the notion of a blog, of course, was entirely out of the question, but let's say a pre-blog blog of his experiences. Here is his fascination simply with stones, which would include the stones that David threw at Goliath, and all the other stones which would appear in European literature. You might have noticed also in some of the manifestations I've showed you how important the key figure of Scheherazade is, the key and ultimate storyteller who, if did not satisfy her audience, would inevitably end up with a broken neck. And I suppose for Scheherazade, every film director has to find an identity. I don't suppose I shall end up with a broken neck, but I will certainly not be able to make any narratives anymore unless I satisfy an audience. And I say that advisedly for somebody who spent a lot of time speaking to you a few days ago, denying narrative in the cinema. Again, all sorts of concerns about landscape, prisoners and locks, obsession with keys, and et cetera, et cetera. There were ways and means that I think probably the project included maybe as many as, I think, five editors in the end, and the editing process was very long, and I was determined to let the editors have a maximum say about how a lot of the material was organized. And there was one particular episode which took place in East Germany in the days of the Cold War, which I was particularly excited about, which gave me all sorts of ideas for future editing structures. Let me just show you a little bit of that section of film, which is relative indeed to a lot of the editing we did on the last film we made, the Telsloop, Night Watching about Rembrandt. Take a look at this.
Sometime in the mid-1960s, Telsloop was moved from Moscow to a checkpoint on a bridge over the river Werra near Kreuzburg on the east-west German border.
Identify yourself.
Wallenberg Raoul, Swedish citizen
and diplomat.
Raoul Wallenberg, Schweizer гражданин и дипломат.
Looper, Tulsa. Henry Purcell, British, writer, patriot.
professional prisoner.
Генри Песел Лупер. Британец, писатель, патриот, профессиональный заключенный.
Докажите это.
Пруфы.
I can't. No papers.
Он не может. У него нет документов.
Зато длинный язык.
He says you have loose tongue.
No, it's firmly anchored to my best interests.
It seems that the Swedish embassy in Berlin had arranged a prisoner exchange for Raoul Wallenberg. And Looper, as a Wallenberg associate, was to be part of the bargain.
Hey, Шахматист.
He asked if you are a good chess player. Hey.
Шведский Валенберг.
Эй, шведский Валенберг,
мне не нужен.
Лупер.
Вот спасибо.
Лупер. Вот кто важен для меня.
Так, пешка.
Пиворава, пешку, которую можно освободить.
Дабы держать в заперти слона Лупера.
Лупера? Я царь Ирод.
Я царь
Ирод. Царица Иродиада проводит вас. Соломея на том конце моста.
Swedish Wallenberg is a pawn Barava. Colonel Kutcher is a king Herod.
Lieutenant Alazarin is a queen Herodiana.
Solomon, away for Danzig across the bridge.
For Danzig across the bridge.
Position as yet unknown on the board. Unknown.
This moment, Herodian takes Solomon's role.
Herod was eaten by worms.
Ирода сожрали черви.
Был не тот! Herod!
Это не тот Herod.
Wrong Herod.
You wish.
Иди! You don't know!
Herod was a Jew.
Herod был евреем.
Нет! Он был ассириец!
Вот! Он был ассирийцем!
Он был ассириец!
The Russian keeper of the bridge was a law unto himself. And he had ideas about prisoner exchange more relevant to personal interests than international politics.
Иродиада скажет тебе, что делать.
Иди, ты пройдешь Соломею.
Иди.
Соломея ждет тебя там. Есть. Это смешно сказать, но тюрьма в Мариинике была известна как известная мальма-матер мастеров-шахматистов. Есть интересная особенность, которой мы гордимся, это упорство наших заключенных, которые продолжают играть в шахматы, даже зная, если их за это ждет смерть. Ну?
Могут ожидать смерти.
Зачем? Упорство.
Chessmen are dispensable.
Mirror on the wall. Who is the greatest chess player of them all?
Посмотрим. Смогу ли я умереть тебя до смерти, играя в шахматы?
Colonel Kutcher considering a game to kill you.
We could effect a compromise.
Англичанин предлагает компромисс.
Никаких компромиссов.
I can play chess for you, not against you. I can be your chess slave.
Он хочет стать вашим рабом.
Ты? Ты и так мой раб. С кем ты собираешься играть? С Лазарин? С Часовым? Или с нашими политическими гостями? Да они скорее предпочтут провести ночь в Сибири, чем полчаса за игрой в шахматы здесь, на самой границе свободы. У меня есть идея получше. Если ты окажешься достойным противником, мы устроим вечный турнир. И вот тут сказано, что ты писатель. Моя жена любит хорошие рассказы. Ты будешь играть в шахматы со мной. И писать рассказы для моей жены.
You are offered two jobs, to play chess and tell stories. For him and for her. Forever, if necessary. And perhaps other things. He wants to become rich, and she wants to be a mother.
I could be your gulag, Scheherazade.
Он хочет изображать принцессу Шахерезаду.
Будь осторожен. Моя жена плохо спит по ночам. Да-да, ей нужны ночные рассказы, чтобы заснуть. А если захочет спать днем, то это будут дневные рассказы. А если утром, то утренние, но без повторов. У нее хорошая память. Три рассказа в день. Я думаю, ты справишься, шахматист.
The contract for three stories a day. Night, afternoon, morning.
Петр, в этом контракте все против тебя. Но кто знает, старайся. Может быть, ты станешь ее главей. Знаток шахмат, вас надо расстрелять. Так кем бы вы предпочли быть? Живым любителем, но без последствий? Или мертвым знатоком? Я думаю, следует устроить испытание. Возьмем вашу доску.
Colonel Kutcher invites you to play chess with him. If you are a successful candidate and respectable player, then you might be allowed to go free.
Но это маловероятно. Я не проигрываю никогда.
Acting for the Swedish Embassy in Berlin, we accept you, Raoul Wallenberg, as our exchange prisoner for Karl Kaczalowski. Known as Rupert the Bear.
Lasset die kleinen Kinder nicht leiden.
Wir bringen euch Bücher. Raoul Wollenberg.
Bekannt als die kleine Meerjungfrau.
Als Austauschgefangenen für Karl Kaczalowski. Bekannt als Robert der Bär.
The Little Mermaid is Danish. You Russians really have to learn some geography.
This, maybe, is the last time that Raoul Wallenberg was officially counted for. It has never been made certain, but it was long considered possible that Wallenberg was kept alive, disappearing into more and more obscure prisons in the Urals and then in Siberia. A curious penalty for a man who so successfully saved so many Jews slaughter in Budapest. Martino Locavelli would say that Wallenberg's fate could sometimes be seen as a parallel blueprint for Looper's own destiny from the late 1960s onwards.
Mr. Lucas was a sentimental man. Divided his enthusiasms equally between his garden and his children. Every time his wife conceived, Mr. Lucas planted a fruit tree. But his wife seldom came to a successful labor, and even those children she was blessed with died soon after she stopped breastfeeding. Mr. Lucas threatened to cut down or uproot all his young trees every time there was a miscarriage or an early infantile death, but he never did.
или ребенок умирал.
Today there are 17 trees in his fruit garden.
В его саду растут 17
деревьев. And he knows them all by their Christian names.
По имени.
Зачем? Зачем эти все истории про натуралистов?
You every time write about naturalists.
And families.
И семьях.
И семьях.
I dream of being the first and of living in the second.
Он мечтает быть натуралистом и семьянином.
Ты можешь быть моим натуралистом и составить с нами счастливую семью.
Это что значит?
Что хочешь.
Colonel Kutchev and Lieutenant Alazarin are disputing meaning of family happy.
It's happy families. It's an English game. I'm sure Colonel Kutchev would enjoy playing it.
Я много видел игр на этом мосту. Мост как большая шахматная доска. На нем все определено и зафиксировано. Основные понятия просты. Начало всегда предсказуемо.
Colonel Kutchev is comparing game of chess as an analogy for prisoner exchange. He suggests that most of them have very strong initial parallels.
Большинство игр заканчивается приемлемой ничьей.
With some satisfaction, he suggests that most of game end in draw.
Like ours. How gratifying.
Story 392. It is a truism that happiness when you are happy is a limited commodity, but misery when you are miserable has no end. Story 393. On foggy nights, people lost the city of Lublin. Experienced travellers could not find it. Long-standing inhabitants shrugged their shoulders and patiently waited in the fields for the fog to lift. Story 394. Two partially sighted women agree to live together to see if their combined sight could find them a man. Eventually, they found four men, one for each eye.
Story 448. Oskar Kokoschka had a life-size doll of Gustav Mahler's widow, Alma. Story 449. Henry VIII, contrary to overexcited public opinion, was not essentially a lustful man. Story 450.
A woman who wanted to see the sea kept a suitcase of drawing pencils under her bed.
Головами с брусельской капусты. Это не пир. Не банкет. Но это все-таки не кулинарное чудо. Но это лучше, чем речная вода с крысиной мочой.
Let them allow it. Encourage you to work on during shift. Prepare modest meal from fish products.
Работает языком.
Да, хорошо. Знаешь, хорошо сосет, лижет, говорит.
Врет, жульничает.
Ну да, ну что ты вообще не жульничает? Он не умеет это жульничать.
Ну разве что.
Когда играет в шахматы, ну ведь это не все.
Нет, когда человек рассказывает байки, он всегда...
Значит, жульничает. Шахматы единственные, они врут.
Знаешь, он меня возьмет туда, куда твои шахматы даже никогда и не доставали. Да, ты никогда меня туда не брал. Ты даже никогда не мечтал, наверное.
Что? Америка, Европа, Париж, Лондон, Амстердам.
Ливерпуль, Париж.
Вон туда можно доехать на поезде.
Ну, ты как всегда. Да, ты как всегда. У него более обширные планы. Знаешь, он возьмет меня сам. Сам, без всякого общественного транспорта.
Вы можете взяться из-за ручки.
Ну, почему бы нет? Я же, знаешь, об этом только и думаю.
Да, я и не сомневаюсь. Скорее, взяться за ручки, а потом, знаешь, так...
Его руки. Его нога, может быть, что у тебя там? Кроме его руки.
А потом ручки.
А ты вспомнила свое любимое занятие, да? Вспомнила.
Это пустое.
Да, зато детей у нас с тобой не бывает.
А как у вас уже до этого дошло, да, до этого.
А что, тебе не нравится? Тебе не нравится, да? Да, да, маленькая. Западные вливания и победа.
И все. А победителей не судят. Ну что? Кто узнает, что это не твой?
Это после 18 лет! Ты знаешь, что думал? Не будет отдавать и когда! Он у меня как дерьмо! По речке будет плавать!
Плавать в речке, сука!
Что не хочет попробовать?
Ну что тебе от этого?
Пожалуйста.
Считалось. После 18 лет. Этого не будет! Не будет этого!
Ну, котик.
Ну, посмотри, Таня. Федя, Фредерик, Элизабет.
Знаешь,
родится мальчик, король. И ты его назовешь. А родится маленькая девочка, пешка, я ее назову.
Но ведь родители это не те, которые родили, а те, которые воспитали. Нет национальности, нет политических пристрастий. Неужели ты не понимаешь?
Моя сперма насквозь пронизана политически.
Моя сперма! Она насквозь политическая, слышишь? Насквозь! Моя сперма насквозь политическая! Моя сперма насквозь политическая!
Может быть, поэтому она вам не бессильна. Она слишком радикальная, твоя сперма. Я слишком красная, слишком радикальная. И свобода
не будет! Не будет! Не будет!
Этого не будет!
Закрой ты на все глаза. Ну, закрой.
Ради бога. Ну, опусти ты.
Опусти свою гребаную гордыню.
Красную гордыню хоть на чуть-чуть, хоть на 2 сантиметра. О, на 2 сантиметра, мне прошу тебя. Я прошу тебя.
Ну, черт, может быть, на 25? Ну.
На 25.
Мне же работать-то.
Ну, что, я надеюсь, что... Я надеюсь, что не без удовольствия.
Король! А ты король! А ты копейка!
Вот они твои 25 сантиметров!
Размечтался! Коче! Коче! Хранитель моста!
Okay, and so it goes on and on and on and on. Okay, let me consider something completely different. The recent film that, let me repeat, we are coming to prepare for the Cannes film festival. It is really, I suppose, a superior cutting copy. It is still needing, as you will see, some post-production, and it still needs a considerable amount of grading and probably some revoicing. We have a big international cast, and some of them, should we say, I'm being very, very, I suppose, modest here, are sometimes a little difficult to understand because of the language difficulties. But I wonder if you could change over the computers for me. For a long, long time, I've been interested in Hendrik Goetzius, mannerist Dutchman, living in the south of Holland, practicing in The Hague, I suppose, from about 1570 to probably about 1617. The Shakespeare fans, you will know that those are approximately the dates, indeed, of Shakespeare. Goetzius was born about 3 years before Shakespeare, and died probably about 3 or 4 years afterwards. He's right in the center, I suppose, of that great period of searching, experimentation. I always think that those periods, intermediary periods between moments of cultural confidence, are always the most exciting. I would suggest that we are probably indeed in one of those moments now. Huge amounts of experimentation. Great interest, I suppose, in the phenomenon about how do you deal with the inheritance left by such enormous Renaissance giants like Michelangelo, Da Vinci, and Raphael. What particularly interested him, although he had indeed ambitions to be a painter, which he fulfilled in later life, was a brand new technology, essentially, which was the technology of the illustrated book created by steel engravings. There had been one or two before, but I think we could say that Goetzius brought the art to its apogee. So a brand new visual technology. So my enthusiasm for Goetzius would also be allied to the fact that I'm interested in the possibility of how every new visual technology gets into bed with lechery. If you think of the introduction, not the very, very beginning, but the maturity of the introduction of oil painting, which surely must be brought to a certain moment of satisfaction in Venice, with certainly people like Titian, the late Bellinis, etc., there was a way that because oil paintings were portable and carryable, they began to attract certain sorts of subject matter which could not probably be seen, even despite Giulio Romano, in fresco on walls which were very, very public and not to be moved. And you know all those paintings by Titian, those extraordinary, beautiful paintings of naked women that almost had no precedence. And essentially, I suppose, from the point of view of the 21st century, we could regard them as classic playboy pinups. They fulfill the same purposes. And of course, if they're comparatively small and portable, you can take them to your bedroom, indeed your privy or your bathhouse, and contemplate them in secret, or at least privately. So the notions, again, there are enormous amounts of pin-ups created in that time, primarily, of course, by the really great painters like Titian, indeed, and Giovanni Bellini, and certainly Giorgione and Tintoretto, but obviously followed by indeed many, many, many other people when the High Renaissance shaded itself indeed off to Mannerism. But then again, if you think, coming much closer to our own time, the early days of photography got into bed very ferociously with notions of erotica and pornography. And the early days of the cinema, likewise, we don't have to be reminded of what the internet has been responsible. And if all of you in this room, as I hope you all are now participants in cyberspace, most popularly certainly in Europe, is the cyberspace referred to as Second Life. Get your pencils out now, www.secondlife.com. Get on it tonight. It's the future of cinema. But completely unpoliced and pushing the boundaries out far and wide about the notion of ideas of satisfying erotica, maybe erotica in that sense as being a representation and not the real thing, could never possibly be satisfactory. But you could see how things have moved from the depiction, mass-produced image of notions of erotica, through to a greater association with a photographic image, then a photographic image that moves, then a photographic image that moves and is in your control. So this particular association, I think, seems to be endemic. There's an obvious reason why it does. Sex sells. So all the new technologies, of course, are happy to harness their associations with such a good selling object. But I think there are other more interesting and more profound associations as our innate curiosity of seeing ourselves in forever more representative media. So I'm going to use this really as, I suppose, a basic excuse to consider indeed the career and events in the life of Golcius. We don't necessarily know that much about the man. He certainly contacted a marriage in association, it is understood, a rich woman to afford the very, very expensive technology he was investing in. It's a bit like Bill Gates and Microsoft insofar as the new technology is very, very expensive. And around about 1590, he sets off on a journey through northern Europe on his way to Italy. His health wasn't particularly good either, and he thought he would be able to recover some of his health and strength in Italy. Mind you, all artists at that time would regard going to Italy, certainly Rome and Florence and Venice, as an absolute necessity. And on the way there, he is documented to stay at the capital of Alsace, Colmar, and try to inveigle the local margrave, the local military governor, into organizing circumstances for him to commission important illustrated books and afford a printing press. Okay, we made a classic, I suppose, 120-minute feature film. My first cutting copy, I have to say, was 4.5 hours long, and I regretted ever having to cut it down, but business is business in the film business, and there's a way in which I've got to be responsible, so we've ended up for 120 minutes. But it is deliberately meant to be an exercise in the actual business of what he, Golcius, did, which is about the manufacture of images. And just as we could see how Golcius himself manufactured those images, you could see me, if you like, as Golcius in the 21st century, manufacturing equivalent cinematic imagery. Let me just show you the very beginning as an introduction, and then I will duck and dive through various other sections of the film to show you some of our ideas, some of the progress of the ideas of which we would like to discuss with you an audience. We have selected, indeed, these six dramatizations which follow six stories of six apparent sexual taboos, certainly once upon a time all crimes, but maybe with the possible exception of paedophilia, all now merely sins and not crimes anymore. The first one, of course, was voyeurism in association with Adam and Eve. The second is incest with Lot and his daughters. The third is David and Bathsheba representing adultery. The fourth is Potiphar's wife with Joseph representing the seduction of the young. The fifth is the story of prostitution of Samson and Delilah. And the last is Salome with the prospect of necrophilia. I will run through some of these and make a, as it were, a demonstration very quickly, always referring again to these very important subject matters, which were part of the iconography, certainly, of the Renaissance and predominantly, indeed, of the period of Mannerism. The subject matter, of course, is continually debated by all manner of people inside the Margrave's palace, and, of course, as you can see, as the supreme lecher, the Margrave himself is trying very hard to get involved in the action. There's all sorts of plotting, indeed, amongst the members of the Pelican Company as well. So a deliberate confusion, let me repeat again, of what is real and what is unreal, what is theatrical and what is so-called really happening. The film is also structured constantly to be critical of itself, and indeed to be critical, I suppose, of all sorts of theatrical and cinematic procedures and characteristics. The original intention that we must see how this film maneuvers in the cultural marketplace, whether in fact we'll be able to raise the money to make part two, which will be the whole drama all over again, but taking this time a summer version of things and to contemplate six stories indeed from Ovid's Metamorphosis. Okay, that's an introduction. As you can see, the film is unfinished. It hopefully will be finished within a couple of weeks, and we hope to present it as a premiere at the Cannes Film Festival. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Peter, for this wonderful show. And indeed, we had announced a conversation. In fact, we are more here to allow the audience to ask a few questions, but I'll just say just a few words, thinking that since we're here in Philadelphia, we've come a long way from Duchamp's Boîte en Valise, since, as you know, Duchamp just used the suitcase to collect his own works and bring them around. Whereas your suitcases and your films go to a sort of universal history. The Bible, the literary and visual culture that you teach us to read and rediscover, I think this is an important element. And perhaps one question I would simply have, and it's not something I had prepared, but it came to me from seeing all this, not only the Looper idea, but the Golsius idea, is how much of the real history do you consider as needed for the sort of literacy that you want to promote, if I understand well?
Well, I'm sure you would basically agree with me. What I was suggesting the last time we spoke was that there's no such thing as history, there's only historians. And, of course, most of our history, too, is basically textual history, so we're requiring all the time on historians who write a text. And also, of course, that leads out so much apparent notions of visual literate ideas of history, too. We're talking here, of course, certainly in this film, about biblical mythology. And as one of the characters said just now, it is intended, surely, to be more about metaphor than reality. There is remarkably little historical truth anywhere evident in the Bible from the very beginning to the end. All the stories of the Bible only have one source, and that is the Bible itself. So we're dealing here with a phenomenon I've always felt was true, that people aren't really interested in history, they're interested in mythology. And I think that an awful lot of people, and we've seen it recently with spectacular films about historical subject matters, certainly in the last decade, so their notions of who Cleopatra is are fixed on Elizabeth Taylor. The people who think of Alexander the Great are other people like Brad Pitt. I suppose it was inevitable that during the 19th century, It was the novel that supplied the circumstances, the historical novel, think of Sir Walter Scott, to enliven the imagination. And when you think, certainly for English history, when we think about, you know, that great Tudor industry that involves Henry VIII and Queen Elizabeth, what most people would remember about Henry VIII, not that he was the first monarchy to separate from the Church of Rome, but that he had six wives. So our manipulation, in, as always, indeed, somebody as great as, I suppose, Gibbon, you know, people take what they want from history in order to make all sorts of parallels associated with their vested interest. So I think mythology is the name of the game, and there is, and has been, right back to all the Roman historians, a very, very subjective notion of what notions of historical truth is. So I think that what I'm engaged in a curious way, is both honorable and creditable.
And critical, too. Yes, yes. And I think this is this side that perhaps we hadn't perceived until you came here, how critical you were of all our mythologies. And perhaps to go back to what you were saying Wednesday, I feel, and I think Alan had the same impression, that there was a tension between the no story, there shouldn't be any, film should not be the narrative of a simple story, but also the proliferation of the stories. How do you account for this? So many stories.
Well, that's true. I think probably that my cinema is always engaged in some sort of notion of a gap between the idea of the documentary and all it's meant to represent and the notion of the feature film. And I think increasingly that association I want to be able to pursue. So it's sort of like the feature film as essay that gives us all a space to debate all sorts of issues, in this case sort of biblical mythology, an opportunity to see what other people have done with it, certainly in terms of painting, and how the cinema dramatizes it, and where the gaps of belief and non-belief and the shimmering impossibilities of actually nailing anything down. It's all a highly mutated, forever moving surface. That, of course, is what I find enormously interesting. I suppose we are told to look for the verities, but surely by the time, you know, we become mature, we know that verities are absolutely impossible. And I suppose, you know, the old-fashioned notion of history would be something for the immature mind who would deliberately wish to grasp on some form of notion of historical truth, which we know just does not exist.
I also wanted to thank you for the gift of screening this. And I had some prepared questions, which should go by the boards now, because I was provoked, as you said I would be. By this. And it occurred to me that you play a lot on the interplay between the actor and the role, or the person and the actor. It's a commonplace that to act is to do two things. It's both to do something and to pretend to do something. Here in this film, you seem to blur those, what should I call them, roles, and in such a way that it seems as if you're arguing that theater is theater is a corollary of living, and in a weird, maybe even perverse way, living is a kind of mandatory theatrical voyeurism. Are we mandatory voyeurs?
Well, I think you're offering that as a rhetorical question, but let me give you a rhetorical answer. You're a member of my ideal audience. Thank you.
Maybe we could ask,
we should probably,
because we won't have too much time and some of you have to go, but if anybody has any question. We had lots of other questions, but I'd like, first of all, again, thank Peter for his generosity in spending his time with us, but also since we've been bombarded by extremely strong visual impressions, it takes some time to let this subside. But if you have any question, if you don't, we will continue. But anybody has any? Yes.
Hi. It doesn't seem to work.
Does it work?
No, not working.
Thank you for your movie. From the extracts we've seen, it was reminding me pretty strongly of The Baby of Macon on one side and of Prospero's books on the other side, and I was wondering if you could describe the way you think your work has evolved since these two movies?
I think probably if you're making a reference to The Baby of Macon, is the notion of the audience, you, the audience, continually represented. So, as it were, an intermedia. I'm creating already my artificial audience on the screen in preparation for showing you the audience. And indeed, and I'm delighted, because it sounds as though you might have seen here in America The Baby of Macon, yes? Hardly ever distributed. But you remember the ending of that, where the audience never finishes, that all audiences are viewed by yet more audiences, all the way back, if you like, to a metaphorical God, the ultimate audience. So I think, you know, that notion that everything we do is being watched, and again, I suppose it's back to those notions of voyeurism. Surely isn't the cinema the most voyeuristic of all media that has ever been, with all its prevarications and all its ambiguities? And it's something that really, really fascinates me. You may have noticed how in the Tulsloopa, the actual character of the ultimate storyteller, Scheherazade, who if she is unsuccessful, it means death, disaster, finish. So I would like to take on, of course, deep sense of irony, to take on that responsibility in terms of convincing you about things, much in the way that Scheherazade had to convince the prince, otherwise indeed off with her head. So I suppose it is, you know, that I suppose both in the work itself and what I was saying a couple of nights ago and what I'm saying now is this extraordinary fascination, but a love-hate with the whole business of narrative. What are we? Do we think we're doing with narrative? Is there a way that really narrative does have a place not only in cinema, but also in all the other art forms? I'm trained as a painter, and I certainly believe the very, very best painting is non-narrative. Is it at all possible, even though we understand we're talking about linear narratives and narratives that move through time, is it in fact possible to make cinema without narrativity, to be able to make the presentations that painting seems to be absolutely capable of doing without being slave to the narrative? Because again, going back to what I was saying, you know, Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter, cinema is a slave of the bookshop. That should surely not be true. We should try and create an autonomy and independence if we really do believe that cinema is the seventh art. So if you like, you can see me struggling with all the sorts of purposes and contradictions and contretemps that are associated with a deeply narrative perceived and organized and I suppose, assimilated world.
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
I want to add something to that, too, and it's a bit confessional. Is a way, though I've made over 200 films, and I suppose the general public would know of me as a filmmaker, I am the author of all these films in the sense that we have a text-based cinema. So in a curious way, my career has been as a writer, not really as necessarily a filmmaker. And if I'm critical of an establishment that really is treating cinema like illustrated text, well, let me bring that home. Isn't that what I myself am doing? You know the famous Godardian notion, because he was against the idea of the scriptwriter. He believed that, of course, cinema should be its own phenomenon and not be a dissolution, if you like, or a substitute for another art form. He would say, okay, let's play the game. I cannot personally. I don't think Godard was a painter, but this situation was the same. You know, we cannot go to a, or let me make it more personal. I cannot go to a studio or a producer with 4 paintings, 15 lithographs, and a book of sketches and drawings and say, give me the money. They won't know what I'm talking about. They won't have the confidence to be able to accept the visual evidence as being a support and a succedaneum and a prop to the whole notion of filmmaking. So Goddard said, let's play the game. Let's write that goddamn script. Let's convince the producer, the people with the money, the people with the power, the people with the networking. Make sure, indeed, they give you the check. Take that check to the bank. Make sure that 3 days go by to be absolutely sure that that check is going to work and not bounce, and then throw the goddamn script away and go make a film. Extremely good advice.
Well put. Everything you've shown us tonight and on Wednesday night, all these different mediums and everything, from the catalogs to the VJ stuff to this, there's, you know, varying levels of fidelity and polish involved in everything, and I wonder, you know, you talked a lot about collaboration last time, and to what degree there's a correlation between your involvement and your control as a benevolent dictator, director, in whatever it is that you're producing, both technically, but also intellectually.
Well, I remember a long, long time ago, the film critics of Time Out, and we're talking about the 1970s, said that Greenaway is anal retentive. He will never let anything go. And his collaborations are all dominated by tyranny and despotism. Well, it is true that I try, I suppose, in association with those famous or infamous theories of the auteur of the 60s and 70s, to certainly hold on to as much of control and of manufacture in all its parts. I'm not a composer, but I've worked with some brilliant composers and music makers, so that's really outside my capabilities. But I did receive, of course, a highly privileged English public school education, and it shows, witness my voice. Most people don't understand what I'm talking about anymore. And I always felt, you know, English is becoming, certainly English, not understandable. I'm quite aware that a Pole speaking English talking to a Colombian speaking English can better understand, either than the Colombian or the Pole can now understand me. Incidentally, I've never understood why you Americans actually still speak English. Why don't you speak American? That's always a big surprise. But I think also with my training, obviously in art school, and I have a certain academic frame of mind, so that's as much theoretical as is practical. And then I spent 10 years in the British film industry learning how to become an editor. And I'm sure that you would agree now, the digital age, the editor is always king, and I don't necessarily mean in terms of cinema, but the editor is the gatekeeper, is the key to the way knowledge is fashioned and presented. So to be an editor in any sort of circumstance and discipline and medium now is an extremely powerful position to be in. And you can see, I'm sure, that these films are incredibly self-consciously edited, very, very deliberately too. Very, very little, as far as I can, is ever left to chance. But I have worked with some extraordinary people. I suppose the people I lean on most of all would be my DOP, director of photography, and I've worked with some extraordinary people, initially starting off with Sacha Vierney, who used to work with Buñuel and René, and he taught both me and all the other DOPs I've worked with since. So I spent an awful lot of time on the film set with my eye behind the eyepiece. That's not so true now because everything, of course, is seen on monitors, but it's the people behind the camera who I value enormously, and also you can see there's a huge amount of music in my films, so although I by no means can write music or conform music in any way, I do have an enormous respect and a great sense of collaboration with the many, many film composers, including, may I humbly say, this gentleman.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you very much for these amazing clips of your movie. I think it's very, very interesting how you used the color in the beginning, using this black and white and red, that was the color of the old books. I think it's very, very beautiful. And I think that your work is very important, not only in cinema and in other medias, but also for art publication. I really love your books, and I was wondering, what is your project? What are you working right now with books?
Thank you. I have this huge program of megalomania. I'm calling it The Historians. And I have a very, very trusting Parisian publisher, and we're working our way through it. The plan is to write 100 books, My God, doesn't that already sound extraordinary, arrogant, and over the top? But I assure you, each book is only 50 pages long and is composed very largely of lists, so that, in some senses, takes away some notion that I might be writing 300-page novels and making them 100 of them. But I would be particularly fascinated by the structure. Like, of these 100 books, book one is about conceptions, book two is about births. Book three is about children's names. Book four is about toys. Book five is about childhood illnesses. Book six is about education. If we go to the other end of the scale, book 94 is about deaths. Book 95 is about funerals. Book 96 is about memorials and cenotaphs. Book 97 is about memory. Book 99 is about reputation. And book 100 is about ghosts. So it's an opportunity to tread through a hypothetical life of 100 years, subscribing each particular year to a particular subject matter is relative to that person during the life. We have published five of these already. I'm now working on book number four, which is about toys, and there are seven more in preparation. Again, as you can see, I certainly have more past than I have future. I just hope there are enough years left to get through this enormous ambition. So that's one of the publishing ventures we do. And also this Devoir is the name of the publisher who they've stayed with me, I suppose, for the last 30 years, and they do publish all the scripts too. The actual idea of publishing scripts and reading them, of course, is a very minority art. Actually, reading with, I suppose, intentionality and total comprehension of film script is not an easy thing to do. But some people, of course, have argued that it's an art form in its own. What I should also draw attention to, I'm a great catalog maker of exhibitions and so on. And again, leaning on my magic number of 92, again, it's my ambition, probably in the next 10 years, to see if we can make 92 catalogs. This is the most latest, and it's number 26, so we still have some way to go. But I like the format of the book as a film, so I'm very, very keen on the notions of sequence. And they're all formatted again, 92 pages, always the same format. First page is number one, 92 is in the back. So with that particular fixture, and a whole series of designers who take on these jobs, there is, in a sense, an umbrella which gives me a format and a confidence to continue to do that sort of excitement. But again, as I was saying before, book into film, film into opera, opera into stage, stage into a website. We are now of an age where this is now possible, creditable, and I believe honorable.
To something that has struck everybody knowing your work, what you were just describing, Peter, the series, the numbers, 92, 100, 14, is this connected with the idea of the encyclopedia? And if it is it still possible today to think of an encyclopedia without having it turn into some kind of farce? Because I'm thinking here of Flaubert with Bouvard and Pécuchet and this kind of endless, relentless engagement with science after science. And so, as we know, Flaubert wanted to make fun of that attempt. Isn't our modernity, if it's a big word, always not condemned to some kind of falling into the farcical element of the encyclopedia?
Well, I think though we might all have an encyclopedic bent in one way or another, we absolutely know that it mocks human effort. It is impossible. It is impossible really to make an encyclopedia. As you suggested, you know, the pace of knowledge and the profundity and the subjectivity of knowledge is so changing all the time that any attempt at an encyclopedia, you know, always has to be updated. I always remember the case of Virginia Woolf's father, who set about trying to make a universal dictionary of English literature. I think he died when he got to the letter K, so he wasn't even halfway through the project. I'm well aware, and I think probably that mocking irony is always built into these situations as well. But again, I mean, we don't necessarily, I mean, there's been a whole trend, isn't there? I mean, let's take French literature. Rabelais to Perec, for example, are all concerned with this phenomenon. One of my Japanese heroes, say, Shonagon, who makes impossible lists, you know, lists of people that go that way and then people who go that way. Lists of things that are sometimes happen in the night and sometimes not. Foucault's reworking of the Borges idea of the famous Chinese Emperor's Encyclopedia. I'm well aware of the mocking nature of even attempting this extraordinary megalomaniac ambition.
It's unhappy time maybe to conclude and thank you. I mean, this is the most productive megalomania I've ever seen and the most enjoyable.